Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Picture this. Tell me this hasn't happened to you. You're at your home and you're ready to sit down to dinner, and all of a sudden you're saying, oh my, you say, oh, I need this document. It's back on my computer at the office. What are you going to do? You're going to have to go back. Nope. It's good news. With GoToMyPC, you don't need to make that trip back to the office, because GoToMyPC, that is brought to you by Citrix, lets you easily access your office PC in just a few clicks. Setup takes probably just about 2 minutes. And just like that, you're free to work from anywhere. GoToMyPC is easy to set up, easy to log into, and easy to use. So be sure to try GoToMyPC. I love it. I use it often because I'm always kind of logging in and, you know, finding information that I left over there and need to grab and actually transfer. But you can do so for 30 days for free. So for this special offer, you go to www.gotomypc.com/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for the free trial. Well, hello, it's Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We are approaching March, hopefully very shortly, because February has been quite a bomb, don't you agree? And we're going to be talking with some great people today, so I'm not going to take up a lot of time in the beginning of this conversation, but I did want to mention to you a couple of things. Number one, we're all the way up to episode number 97. That means that we are three episodes away or so from a special 100th anniversary, and you need to make sure to be there for that, because we're going to have a whole slew of picks and pans and things to do and things to stay away from for the next movement, as we're going to see it, as we see towards the next kind of, I guess, the turnaround, maybe not turn up, but the turnaround from where we are right now, which is this gruesome tale, this horrific kind of story of the stock market, and a lot of things that are going on in terms of the government. I guess, you know, all told, the one thing I want to bring to you today is that I was thinking about this very carefully, and I was thinking, you know, for a long time, we've had a lot of things to contend with, right? We've had unemployment issues, we've had earnings, we've had just fraud, we've had fraud, we've had fraud, lack of transparency, manipulation. You know, all of those pale in comparison to something. You know what that is? Government intervention. Are they going to nationalize or not? Are they going to give us a whole hunk of money or not? Are they going to stimulate or not? Are they going to come in like they did last week on Friday at 2:30 and then again at 2:59? Kind of like the, you know, here we are, plunge protection team or whatever is being called, to actually put in some spot of good news. You know, Senator Dodd, I mean, this is a guy that you just want to say, sir, what are you doing? I mean, did you see what he did? He comes out in the morning on Friday and says, you know, it may be a good idea to start nationalizing the banks. Well, needless to say, the banks and the markets weren't too happy about that. Then all of a sudden, we saw at 2:59, actually 2:20, 2:30, and 2:59, an announcement, well-placed, well-planned on option expiration day, to actually say, well, you know what? We're not going to let that. No matter what happens, at least we're going to try our hardest not to let the banks go under. We're not going to let them be we may let them go under, but we're not going to nationalize them. Well, on one hand, that's a good thing. We don't want to see the banks nationalized because, of course, we do not want to have a government intervention with regard to to our markets. On the other hand, what are we to do? We have Vikram Pandit saying that everything's okay, that their balance sheet is really strong at Citibank, and on the other hand, we're seeing really some big problems there. But nonetheless, I think that we all have to realize that the thing I'm talking about here is, you know, while we've had to deal with ups and downs in the markets, the biggest issue right now is the intervention and the absolute crazy amount, I mean, unheard of amount, of the government in their involvement in the markets. I mean, it's, you know, they're trying to take a path that is very much opposite of what Japan did. They don't want the lost decade. You know, they don't want to get into a situation where we're just sitting there and doing nothing and watching everything just wither away. But on the other hand, there needs to be an end to this. We cannot have markets functioning normally. They just don't function normally with this much government oversight slash intervention. Now, not oversight in terms of course, regulation, because some regulation is desperately needed. But I'm talking about the oversight, kind of the onlooking, rather than just, you know, making sure that they are there to regulate. Because right now what they're doing is they're the ones that are really almost, I would say, really almost on a daily basis, totally involved in the markets and what's going on. And we're all waiting for what they're going to do next as a signal whether or not to invest. Now, I'll tell you what we did on Friday for our clients in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. We took a little bit of an interesting tact to this. And I want you to think about this for a second. If you look back and you look back on the, matter of fact, we put this post that I'm going to talk about right now on the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. We have that client blog where we have. And if you want a free trial to this, you can get a 10-day free trial, kind of a test drive. Just write to trials at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You'll get this. But here's what we did. We looked at the past options expiration date, the third Friday of the month, where options expire. You know, options are monthly and they roll over. What we found was an extraordinary amount of volatility those days, particularly in the area of just the general markets and in terms of volume, okay? Just a tremendous amount of movement. Matter of fact, we've seen some top to bottoms about 4 and 5%. Well, we figured that this probably was going to happen again, maybe not to the extent right now, because a lot of the market participation, the participants are just not there, kind of sitting on the sidelines saying either one of two things. We're going to wait till things get a little bit better, or you know what? Forget about it. We're not involved anymore. This is just, you know, at a point that people are just fully disgusted with the way the market's been running. But let's just say for a moment, hypothetically, that there are some people on the sidelines and they're playing around and all, and you know, little in, little out, and you know, they're investing, they're scalping, they're day trading, whatever they're doing. Okay. Now, what we figured was that sometime during the day, there'd be a pretty good sell-off during the day, as we saw the sentiment erode throughout the week. You know, Dow Jones and the S&P down about, 6.5% or 7% for the week. But at the same time, figured that there will be a moment, or at least one moment, that we will see a sharp rise, just a tremendous rise off the bottom. And in doing so, we want to be positioned well. We've seen this more times than I can tell you. On option expiration. And then what happens is on the backside, kind of starts to slowly but surely on Monday, maybe we'll see a little bit of a rise, but then it starts to fade from there the next days after option expiration. So what we want to do is we want to get positioned well. So we took all of our long position hedges, right? So we have, short position. Let me say that again. We took our short position hedges, things like SDS, the double inverse. We had that on our portfolios last week that saved us a tremendous amount of money, made a nice profit there. We had the QID on the NASDAQ. We had the small caps, the Russell 2000 small caps, and we had these all short. Now, what we did was on Thursday evening before the option expiration date, we flipped those to their counterparties, their sisters, same sister investor. I mean, it's like, for example, SDS, we swapped for SSO, okay, which is the double positive. And we took a half position, a little more than a half position, figuring that we may have some sell-off throughout the day, and we would add to that during the day on Friday. This was the plan. Because we thought there would be some kind of dramatic up. Now, the plan went further to say that if we saw a dramatic up and at the end of the day up that held, we would flip it over and take out our profits and move right back to these short hedges. If, in fact, we saw just a movement, but then a move down slightly, at least that was going to be a good sign for the markets temporarily. It would show that there is a little bit of bullishness in there, and that would be, I think, very much like in terms of the markets, especially with what we have probably coming next week from Geithner. Okay, there's the background for you. Okay, hopefully you followed all that. And again, we'll put a little bit of I think we'll put the chart, at least a link to the chart so you can see what we're talking about there on the site. Now picture this, right? So you have these huge rallies sometimes during the day. Wouldn't you know it? That's exactly what happened. There was a big sell-off after Dodd talked about the nationalization of banks. And then miraculously at about 2 o'clock, the time that you would think it would happen, around there, we started getting this dramatic rally. In fact, we even picked up a double on the financials, figuring there was not much more downside at the point where we saw it on Thursday night and Friday. And we're actually up on that position ever so slightly. And the other three positions were pretty much even on, slightly down or whatever. The point is, though, that these are the kind of things that you want to watch for. You want to watch for these aberrations in this kind of market. You've heard it 100 times. You're going to hear it again. It is a trader's market. It is not just a simple buy and hold. Look what happened. We're going to write a little piece up for MSN. You need to see about Warren Buffett. And if it's not up, you're going to be the first to hear. The question is Warren Buffett getting margin calls? Yes, you heard that right. Is that happening? Why did he sell his quality positions at the end of last year? Why is it that we're hearing some rumor on the street that there are some margin calls coming from these positions in derivative securities and the options on the put option, so to speak, that he has and that possibly are going to cost him in the $12 to $20 billion range if he's wrong, $40 billion if everything just goes to zero, which is not going to happen. But about $12 billion or something like that, absurd amount of money on something that he said he was never going to invest in. Wow. I mean, and to think that he has sold so many positions that he owned, I mean, that's interesting for Buffett, especially after all this time I've been hearing all these things about, you know, Buffett this and Buffett that, and Buffett said buy now in October, bad call. Buffett bought some Harley-Davidson notes right before the thing collapsed in 2-3 weeks ago, so his notes are probably safe. He bought Goldman Sachs. That was so far underwater. And I mean, just, you know, we need to kind of be careful about what we're listening to and how we're listening to. And if I hear one more time the word lazy portfolio, I may puke. The idea of it is just absolutely unsettling and frightening. I wouldn't do it with my worst enemy's money because I think it's just a reckless way to invest. The thought that you could be just lazy and not do any research, and the whole thing is just downright silly. Downright silly. Anyway, I told you I wasn't going to take up too much of your time. You know me, I get into a little bit of a rant and a rock and roll there. I'm going to be on a couple of shows. John Stewart, I'm going taping this week up in New York. If you missed me, I'll be on The Money on Monday evening as well. And a couple other things are coming up. I got some videos on MSN as well. Officially won the MSN Strategy Lab, 14.5% up. Hopefully you got your free book, The Disciplined Investor. And we're going to get right on the horn. We got two back-to-back guests that I'm going to hook up today. We have, first of all, from thestreet.com, a fine gentleman. We're gonna actually talk with him today. But first, we're going to talk with David Gaffin. Oh, sorry. Who is that? Who is that fine gentleman that I'm going to talk to? Frank Curzio from thestreet.com. And I'm actually going to be writing for them shortly on their Real Money site. And David Gaffin from the Wall Street Journal, another good guy that I think we're going to be able to get a lot of good information from on the housing market and what's going on moving forward. These are the kind of people I love having on. If you have anybody that you want to get on here, by the way, somebody that you think that I haven't had on just yet that may be a good guest, just drop us a line at any time. And if you want that trial, if you want to check out what we're talking to our clients about, no strings attached, just drop us a note at trials@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Okay? I think we covered a lot of things, probably lots more to talk about, but we'll hold off right now. Let me get the magic of the Skype going, and we're going to hook up with our first guest. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And with a good friend of mine today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, David Gaffin over at the Wall Street Journal. He is a great writer, insightful. He tracks the blogs, he tracks the writers out there, and is... a gentleman who I turn to get information often. So how are you, my friend?
Good, good. How are you?
Good. How's the weather up in New York?
Oh, it's pretty good. It's been a little cold and, you know, been a bit of a cold winter, but, you know, things have gotten a little better of late. So yeah. You know, that's a good thing at least.
I had the opportunity to be in New York last week and I saw this very startling sight. I walked into the gift shop and I don't know what I was getting something. And I saw a pack of cigarettes for $9.69 plus tax. Have you seen this?
I have not seen this.
I don't smoke. It's definitely, unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, recessions have a way of breaking bad habits, I would think, but probably
it
not.
It seems that way. I mean, $10 a pack, that's what? That could be a habit of 100-something a week or so. So let me ask something. You've been tracking this whole disastrous market, and we've been talking about this a lot. And without beating this, this to death. But what is the story? I mean, are we going to see any end to what's going on in this whole entire banking sector?
You know, it's funny. It just doesn't seem like it's ever going to end sometimes. And that's kind of the worst thing is that it just, you know, sort of has this sort of dreary, ongoing, mind-numbing kind of, you know, every day, you know, just a drudging kind of, you know, move along where just we seem to be going nowhere. It's sort of like a death spiral almost, and the stocks just keep going down and they don't really find any support. And, you know, I think that it seems like people are starting to, I don't want to say getting comfortable with, but that might be the phrase, accepting the possibility of, and I don't want to say nationalization either because it's such a bad word, but essentially some sort of way in which the government steps in, cuts these banks up, gets the bad assets off the books, and then the ones that aren't in good shape, sell them off to the stronger players, which it then capitalizes in one way or another. I mean, and they haven't said they're going to do this explicitly, but they're not ruling it out either. Yeah. Because there's this growing sort of chorus that says we don't want to end up like Japan, which sort of dithered around for about 10 years and never took the step of, you know, writing off bad assets and getting rid of these, you know, zombie banks, as people are calling them. And so, you know, we tend to be ones who are pretty good with, you know, as they say, creative destruction. You know, we don't tend to like to let these things linger, except when companies get way too big to fail. But I think even people are starting to accept that now, accept the idea that, you know, we have to move on somehow, as horrifying and as painful as it's going to be.
Well, it seems to me, Dave, it seems to me that, you know, let's skip over a similar discussion, but just for a moment, to the auto industry. And somebody said to me today, what do you think? Is the auto industry, you know, GM, Ford, Chrysler, are they going to fail? What's going to happen? I said, you know, it's amazing to me. I mean, I know it's terrible. They pretty much just, GM wrote off, what, 50,000 employees. They said they were going to release this week. And, you know, they asked for, you know, talking about mind numbing. I was under the impression, of course, you know, wink, wink, that they only needed, you know, $8 or $10 billion to get through their hardship time. And that was a whopping 1 month ago. And now they need like $30 billion to get through this hard time, which doesn't assure us they're going to get there either. But I got to tell you something. $30 billion to a company, I don't care who they are, they do not have the right to get the money from the government, from us as taxpayers, when there's other companies that, while they are doing poorly, are not at the same level. There is no excuse in a free market. Now, again, you have to say, you know, are we free market? Are we socialist? Are we quasi? Where are we, right? But if we're in a free market environment, there is no excuse for giving money to a company that produces cars.
Well, it seems like, to be perfectly honest, I feel like GM, what they excel most at right now is throwing out gigantic numbers about how great everything is going to be if they get all the money that they want and how bad it's going to be if they don't. You know, their presentation and the comments that they made, you know, it's like we need $16 billion now and then car sales will go back to $14.5 billion annually adjusted by, I think it was 2012, which is a much more optimistic figure than most people expect. They estimate, you know, around 10 to 11 or so, or, you know, baseline around 10.5 for million. That's for 2009. But if you annualize January, and even though that's a slow month, you know, you end up with about 9.6 million. So they're still modeling optimistic expectations.
That's an interesting
thing.
That's
On the other side of this, just sorry to interrupt you, but the other side of this is then they're saying that if they were to go bankrupt or have to go through a bankruptcy, it would cost the government $100 billion. So it's, you know, give me my money now or it's going to cost all sorts of money later. You know, and I just wonder if there's not some way, somehow, that this situation is worked out where, you know, we maintain the production facilities somehow, get rid of management, and work out these situations with the bondholders and with the unions and try to get this to a manageable situation, because this is not going to be for several years now. You know, we have low car sales and we have a lousy economy, and it's going to be for quite a long time.
Yeah, well, the Fed said yesterday that we're not going to see any significant growth for at least 5 years, and we're not going to see any real benefit and change the employment situation significantly for to the end of 2011, I believe they said. But let me ask you this. So now you got this auto industry that's hanging over us, that's giving us a lot of, you know, they're basically putting our feet to the fire and saying, if you don't, it's going to get a lot worse. I mean, you know, that's essentially what's happening there. The banking industry, I don't think they're much different, although, of course, we got to find a lot of humor, I think humor at least, in the fact that Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs want to give back their TARP money because, of course, they don't need it now. Very interesting, though, of course, that was right after there was clamps put on them for executive compensation. Do you think there's any kind of correlation there, my friend?
Yeah, geez, I don't know. Perhaps.
Perhaps a slight one.
Perhaps there might be something. Yeah. You know, it's just a funny feeling.
Yeah. So
yeah,
now,
no, absolutely. It's just we're in a tough situation right now, and I don't like to take this, you know, a lot of people are taking a dogmatic kind of approach and saying, you know, well, this is socialism, and that's a real sort of misapplication of the word, because it implies a government control of production that doesn't exist. You know, the government has always invested in different industries for right or wrong. So, you know, the fact that we're doing more of it, you know, does not make it into socialism, in my opinion, particularly when you consider the fact that, you know, we haven't had an economy like this in a long, long time.
Right.
And so the sort of, you know, analysis that suggests we all just suck it up and deal, to me, just doesn't hold water. Yeah. That doesn't fly. I mean, we saw how that turned out when the government did that with Lehman Brothers, where they just said, well, heck with it. Yeah, and look where we are now.
Yep. And that was just one. That was just one big boy.
And that was just one. That was one. And maybe they thought that after Bear Stearns, which they engineered, you know, the J.P. Morgan takeover, which was arguably the right thing to do, and after bailing out Fannie and Freddie and doing what they had to do with AIG, which, you know, doesn't seem to exist in this strange sort of way that it is, they said, well, we got to let one go, when they really should have facilitated another takeover, and that would have just moved out things considerably.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, It's all well and good to have this sort of ongoing economic theory that says that, you know, we need to have prices fall to their natural clearing level, and they do,
right,
admittedly. But, you know, prices overshot for so long that they can fall to a lower level for a long time too, and that goes for housing and a lot of other things that affect a lot of people. And, you know, there's no earthly reason to want that,
right,
other than to satisfy somebody's, you know, sort of economic theories.
Right.
And so, sorry to go off on a rant there.
No, I understand.
That,
but let me ask you this: since you're, you know,
sure,
I know you write about, you know, you track a lot of the blogs, and yep, you know, you talk a lot of people about what's going on. So let me reel you back for a second in terms of, if you look back, I mean, this is some weird theory, like, okay, this whole entire thing started with a guy at, you know, the McDonald's that didn't have the correct change, and he threw the entire banking system out of whack. You know, I mean, not that crazy, but what do you think turned this entire, if the economy was a well-balanced ball, right, on top of a pin, let's call it, right, what was it that just tipped it to a point that pushed it right over in, let's just say September, then October came, of course, but let's say September or so, that pushed this whole thing right out of whack and caused a lot of this, is it something that you can identify, which was the root cause of all this? Aside from just the housing, was there anything else that you can pinpoint that really was the last straw that broke the economy's back?
Well, the economy, that's a tough one, because the markets, I think you can definitely link it to Lehman Brothers. You know, a lot of people do that. You know, credit spreads blew out, and all of a sudden people just didn't trust each other to lend to one another overnight. The simplest, most basic transactions that go on in the market every day were just sort of scratch that. We're not doing that. So that's where that stemmed from. And then from there, maybe it was the ongoing malaise in the stock market, and you have sort of an accelerating decline in housing prices, and, you know, the credit markets freezing up and eliminating or reducing completely borrowing capabilities that people needed to continue to fund things. I think those things all sort of hit at once, and things really, I don't know, the economy seemed to really almost stop dead in late November.
Yeah.
You know, and we haven't seen it pick up since.
Right.
You know, there was a little bit of growth in the third quarter, I think. Oh, no, now it's negative, actually. You know, but it was a little bit of growth in early September, and then the rest of the economy was sort of moving along in October while the financial services industry was cracking up.
Right.
But I can't think of what the one event was or the thing that really tipped it over the cliff in terms of the economy. Maybe I think just the buildup of, you know, the declines that we saw in the markets and the worries in housing and the credit market problems and all of that together, and people just, you know, retreated into their shell and stopped, you know, doing anything in December. And it hasn't, you know, that hasn't, you know.
Well, I'll throw my 2 cents in here. And
sure.
My theory is that the topple, of course, a lot of the things in the markets, I agree with you with Lehman and the credit also, but what really started to put the brakes on the economy was the exorbitant cost of fuel. I think that when you hit somebody in the pocketbook,
mm-hmm,
right immediately, you know, that's and by the way, I think that one of the stimulus plans should be to release the tax that is paid on gasoline. That would be a lot of money instantly in the pockets of consumers. Not everybody, of course, drives, and then you have that issue that it's not fair. But I mean, this whole thing isn't fair, so I'm not really even going there anyway. But, you know, I think that the cost of fuel just, I mean, freaked people out. I mean, really freaked people out. Come on. You go to a gas pump. I mean, I don't know if you drive in New York. A lot of people in New York don't drive. But I mean, you go to a fuel pump and it's like $4. You're like, I'm not doing this.
Yep.
you know, and this is the whole, and you get really nervous.
I think that's a pretty good way of thinking of it, especially because, you know, if you think about it, I sort of think of it as a series of uppercuts the economy took. And the fuel price spike was really the summer. And so even though they tried to push through this, you know, temporary sort of stimulus where they sent out rebates to everybody, the bounce in fuel prices really knocked people down there for a few months. And so you had that first, and that really started, people start to really sort of, it takes time, but they start to change their expectations, they start to change their behavior. And that's what they started to do when fuel prices went up. So you have that, and then that leads into the fall, and it leads into Lehman Brothers and AIG, and the credit market's getting in trouble, and the stock market really starting to fall off then.
Yep.
So, you know, fresh off of what happens with gas prices, which I think is, you know, as far as the economy, is very valid in terms of, you know, what it did, you know, to knock down consumer spending. You know, then all these other things hit, and people just get shell-shocked.
Yep.
And that's kind of where we stand now.
Yep.
And
So, by the way, that's very valid.
Yeah,
and I'll share this with you, and I've shared this before, and I don't want to get you in trouble, but I also have tracked back what I believe and who the culprits were in the whole gasoline oil movement and the speculation, which wasn't, of course, speculation, wink, wink, again, back in the summer. And without my listeners know that I harp on this all too often. But I think that it would be really great if we could do just a little bit of an investigation and smack somebody a little bit in the head for what they did and say, you know what, guys, you can't go, you know, greed is one thing, but, you know, outright thievery is another. And you know who the guys I'm talking about, and we'll just leave it at that. Let's ask you another question about the economy. What, if not saving the banks at this point, which I don't know if who's saving what and what works, whether or not the mortgage is saved, whether the housing is saved, whether an $800 billion bill, which was meant to be one thing but really another, which doesn't have full spending until about 2011. What is it, as you see, that may be the catalyst to take us out of this? Aside from another speech about boldly going where no one has gone before by a president, okay?
Yeah, understood. And I think that he took a little bit of a hit when Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner's presentation did not go over well.
But wait, may I interrupt you? I need to interrupt you. Did you see the Washington Post article that talked about...
I did.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
That was ugly.
And I actually regained a little bit of my faith in him in that, because it suggested that he saw a plan that was going to be unworkable, that was going to hurt the U.S. dollar, that was going to hurt our treasury bond market and send yields rising higher, and as a result, you know, make mortgages more expensive. And he backed off and said, this one's not going to fly. So he had nothing else prepared. His plan B is tough to come up with when, you know, on the fly.
Right.
So he went back to sort of the vague homilies, and that annoyed the stock market a lot. Now, my opinion of the stock market's, you know, ability to understand the merits of any kind of plan one way or another is not very high, because I, you know, it is a short-term, give me my money now kind of environment where if you promise to hand out free candy on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, the market will rally.
Right.
And if you want to scold them, the market will not rally, you know, and so, you know, time will tell better with that sort of thing. But it didn't help, you know, when Geithner's speech. So, you know, the speeches aren't just going to help. It does appear that Obama's speech and the plan that they put together for housing has been received better, that economists are looking at it and saying that it does contain provisions that, you know, cause people in the market to make market-based decisions, you know, with certain carrots, of course, and sticks, you know, and that type of prodding may help sort of cushion this a little bit, even though it could go a lot further in the minds of some. That will help, and it will take time, unfortunately.
Right.
That, and then the banks, you know, and that's the sort of unknown area right now, because they're not lending.
Right.
You know, or they are lending, but it's just not making up for the securitization markets.
Right.
So, you know, I wish I had a better answer.
All right,
it's going to take more time.
Yeah,
and then
no,
the stimulus bill,
yeah,
you know, will help. It's a slower going one, but then you could argue that in this type of economic situation, a rough one like this, you know, you would need spending that isn't just going to all happen in the next month, which would do not much more than to, you know, to goose the economy rather than really try to put it on a path of growth, so to speak.
Right.
So anyway, you know.
Yeah, so let me ask you this question. So let's talk about the individual investor here who is pretty much, as I see it, out of the market. You know, these are not the investors that are moving things back and forth. They've had a lot of reliance on Warren Buffett, who I want to get to in that in a second, because that's a very disturbing factor. I've taken a lot of hits because people say that I am not an investor. I'm a speculator. I say, what are you talking about? Well, you're supposed to buy and hold. You're not supposed to short. I'm thinking, why not? Who said I can? Who said that? And, you know, then they say, well, look at Warren Buffett, the greatest guy in the world, this and that. And I'm thinking, okay, that's great. You know, he buys and holds forever and all that. But all of a sudden, alas, we find out this week that that ain't so, Joe. You know, that all of a sudden he's actually selling a lot of things. And why he's doing that is an interesting question. His portfolio looks terrible. If you look at his portfolio, it's really a monstrosity. If you didn't know it was him, listen, if you didn't know it was Warren Buffett and you opened up that portfolio and looked at it, what would you think?
Oh, yeah, you'd wonder what was going on there.
Yeah, like, what's the matter with this guy?
Right.
You know? But you know, you look at the whole situation, and the average investor who's in mutual funds and who was told several times not to sell anything, that things will come back, what are they to do these days?
Oh, God, it's so hard because the markets have come down so far, so now what do you do?
Right, so now
Now do you sell?
No, now do I sell? It's too
hard.
Right.
No, I mean, it's like, what do you do now? You know, I have no earthly clue.
I think,
you know, if you were smart enough to take a little bit off, be happy. And I think then when people say diversify, make sure that means cash and hard assets and gold and, you know, everything else right now. Because it's not just going to be stocks.
Right.
You know, and eventually they will come back. They always do. It takes time. And this time it's going to take a long time.
Right.
But, you know, we are giving birth now to a generation, or at least a half generation of people who are going to look at the stock market and say, what, are you crazy?
Yep.
Which is how people in the 30s and 40s looked at it.
Right. Those are depression babies. No, we're called bubble babies, I think.
Yes, we are.
We're bubble
babies. We went from bubble to bubble to bubble.
Yeah, I don't know if that's been coined yet.
Stocks always go up. Yep. You know, stocks always go up. You know,
if you haven't heard that before,
gotta buy the dips.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, buy all the dips. Exactly right.
Buy the dips.
Thank you. Thank you, Lake Mason.
Gotta get back in. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, now what?
Right.
You know.
Yeah, Bill Miller proved us on that one.
Yeah, and if you're younger and you have a lot of investment in stocks and your retirement is 25 to 30 years off, well, you know, you live with it, you know, and you just say, you know, this is part of what happens, you know, and if your retirement is in 3 or 4 years, well, that's a much different story.
Much different. So let me ask you something as a quote-unquote newspaper man. Okay, how long have you been in this business, by the way?
In journalism, I've been in it since 1995, so that's, I guess, almost 14 years.
All right, so you're a journalist, not a newspaper man.
Well, I was at a newspaper, and then I was at, you know, I've been in a couple of newspapers and a couple of one magazine, so online.
Right.
So,
well, now you're a video guy, too, don't forget. I mean, I see, you know, Wall Street Journal. And by the way, your site is awesome, seriously. Your site, you did I mean, it's so hard to come up with something new and fresh these days. You know, it's been done already, right? But you guys at the Wall Street Journal have done a really tremendous job at creating a, we'll call it an interactive site. I think that's the best way to discuss it, right? An interactive media, news media, you know, with your embedded videos and all that. Very nice. Well done. Seriously.
So, thanks. I appreciate it.
So,
yeah, it's a lot.
You know me, I'm the first guy to criticize, so that's pretty good. So I have a question now as a newspaper guy, and then we'll wrap it up. You know, I'm detecting, call me cynical, but I'm detecting that the information that's being delivered in the form of press releases, more so than ever, is so carefully wrapped and touched up and delivered to, let's say, you or anybody else out there, that, you know, about earnings, about company information, it is so carefully PR'd and marketed that it's not just the news anymore. I'm talking about the things that's delivered to you before you rip through it and come up with the, you know, your side of it, right? Do you think there's some validity to that?
Yeah, I mean, people have gotten a lot more savvy in selling themselves, so to speak, and selling what they're putting out there and, you know, trying to, you know, put as high a gloss on it as possible.
Right.
And I think a lot of people bought that for a long time.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, we've been buying, you know, bill of goods for quite a while, you know, and so, you know, you tend to try to take things as critically as you can, but it's not always easy.
Right.
And then you miss something and then forget it. You know, when you're, you know, and these, you're not even so much sold on a particular press release, but on a particular concept. You know, where you've got all this talk about securitization out, and it spreads the risk around, and it does this and that. And there's, you know what, maybe that's all right. You know, and now you look back and you say, well, God, that was a ridiculous notion. You know, and so I'm running a little far afield of your question here, but it's kind of, you know, so.
No, that's the answer to the question. That's it. Yeah, no, that's it. Let me tell you something. I, you know, anybody could be right or wrong. I mean, that's an obvious point on a topic. And I will tell you that I've talked about this before. I had an experience with another major firm, major paper, and I had a nice relationship with a gentleman. And I brought him five or six stories to talk about. I said, you know what? Here's a good stock that you may want to consider. It was a short on this. One of them was Capital One. One of them was the Crocs. One of them was VM. I gave him five or six. He ran a story on one of them and citing my research. And I said to myself, as I stepped back from all that, after about 2 months, kind of almost arguing with him about, here, I have some good ideas here. And they really did turn out to be good ideas. Let's just go with that for a minute, okay? And one of them I was absolute about. Actually, two of them I was absolute about. One of them was VMware, dropped 50 points on the earnings, and I said it was a short and didn't do anything about it. Oh, I didn't get to it. I said, okay. Well, here's another one on the silver platter. There's a giant securitization cancer on his balance sheet. Big problem, Capital One. It was like 50 bucks. Now it's like 10. And he argued and argued and argued and argued that it's not going to happen. Unemployment's not going to breach 6.5, which would be on the high side, blah, 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 blah. And I said, and this is a pretty well-respected guy. And I looked at all the different picks I gave him. And you know what the one he ran? The one he ran, the difference between all of them was five of the ones that I gave him were short. One was a long. He ran the long. Isn't that odd? That's a little weird. But
a little weird.
Well, obviously too bullish, obviously. But the other thing is, and this is what I want to get to, is, you know, Hewlett-Packard recently, you may not be up on this particular thing, but it's more conceptual. Hewlett-Packard comes out with an announcement about 2.5 months ago that they are going to beat earnings and that they look like they are going to be able to meet their annual earnings and revenue numbers. Stock goes up dramatically and everybody's applauding. And I'm thinking, what just happened? Wait a minute.
Right.
How do they have this clarity and visibility, number one? And number two, how are they in their right mind thinking just for even a second that they are going to actually beat numbers? I don't understand that. That makes no sense to me. And I thought to myself, you know, I said, what a brilliant idea. They can't be wrong. If they come out in 3 months or 6 months from now and the crap hits the fan and earnings are no good, they get to say, you know, things were a lot worse than we anticipated.
And of course.
And if they come out even close to it, they could say, you see, because, you know, they were pretty in bad shape back then. You know, you see, we were right about this, and we think that we're really going to continue to our numbers. And, of course, Hewlett-Packard's a great company, much better than anybody else's. Well, lo and behold, last night they come out with the earnings. They come out with a $3 billion revenue shortfall. They come up short on their earnings, and they shorten up their projections. Well, duh. Right. And nobody says anything about, didn't you want to talk about how you were so off on the last quarter? What happened? Where was that? Where are we with this? The stock's getting beaten, but I got to tell you something. This is going on quite, in my opinion, too often because, I don't know if this is criminal or what it is, but as an average investor, an average reader, what are we to make about the crap that's being slung at us?
Oh, it's like you can't trust any of it. And essentially, you know, they have their wiggle room because they've got the thing at the bottom that says that, you know, this should not be taken as a such and such, and, you know, we can't, you know, necessarily judge our results, and this, you know, all the caveats are there. So they can sort of, you know, unless they come out with something ridiculous, they can, you know, say this was our reasonable best guess at the time and it didn't pan out. But, you know, we're in a period where, you know, the writing's on the wall. I mean, you can see what's happening out there in this economy. For someone to come out with some baldly optimistic thing and say we're doing great, you know, even though the whole rest of our industry is doing terrible, you know, you can't trust it at all, but I mean, I think that, you know, as far as what the stock did or what it's doing today is that I think that investors have voted on this one with their feet, to use a phrase I don't usually like, because I don't think there's a lot of, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of real money in there right now.
Right.
A lot of people are, you know, so you have a lot of short-term money, and that's what they do. I mean, they're really here to make quick gains, so, you know, they say things are going to be great, fine. This thing's up 10%, I'll sell it and make a little bit of money.
Yep.
Come out a few months later, things aren't great, fine, I'm shorting it down, good, I made a little money here. So, you know, it's like the day-to-day movements, I can't worry about them so much because I know there's so much noise in there, there's so many people that are, you know, just playing,
right,
you know, what the company said.
Right.
You know, I mean, maybe I'm a little too, you know, laissez-faire about this, but that's just kind of my you know, take on it.
I hear you.
You know, but it's like I try not to trust it, and I don't think a lot of people trust it at all right now.
Right.
You know, there's no point.
Yep. So finally, in closing, what do you think about your industry right now? I mean, you're a little bit nervous about what's going on?
Well, you know, it's a shrinking industry, unfortunately.
Isn't this something we saw back in the days of the internet? We knew this was going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it just turned out that it's just taken a while. You know, people have just found their ways to get information in other less aggregated ways. And, you know, a lot of media companies have bought up a lot of properties and, you know, they you know, their information ends up taking on kind of a, you know, similar sort of gloss to it sometimes. And
then you had the secondary problem that you had, of course, bloggers. Bloggers came in out of nowhere as all of a sudden a news source, which I'm sure aggravates you to no end. And
well,
I
yes
appreciate
and no.
it.
You know, I mean, I like the good ones, especially because, you know, it's a different kind of perspective. And who's to say, you know, there is and there isn't, you know, legitimacy there, particularly ones that are reported, you know. But then the ones that are just rants, I mean, you can't trust that as a news source, you know.
Without any fundamentals, any backup and all that, because there's no vetting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's no vetting. I got to tell you something. I write for a couple of groups, and nobody reads my material before I post it, and we're talking about big audiences.
Right, and that's where you run into
that
trouble.
Makes me a little nervous. That makes me nervous. Yeah. I'm the one that's writing it. I'm nervous. You know
absolutely.
What I'm saying? So, you know, because I wonder who else is writing and not, isn't vetted, or at least, let's put it this way, at least a spell check. You know what I'm saying? At least a little something, so... All right, David Gaffin, I appreciate it. Best way to get in touch with you, I guess, is over at the Wall Street Journal, the blogs. You write the Market Watch. Of course, you write – what else do you write? You write anything else these days? What else do you write?
It's just the Market Beat blog is my main thing.
Yep, Market Beat's enough. You got a lot going on there.
Yep.
A lot going on there. Well, I appreciate you coming on, and I'm sure we'll see you real soon.
All right. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks a lot.
Good to talk to you.
Same here. Bye-bye.
Take care.
And we're kicking it up with a friend of mine, Frank Curzio. He has an awesome podcast that is available on iTunes, and it is called The Real Story. He's with TheStreet.com and all-around good guy. How are you, buddy?
Good. How's it going, Andrew?
Oh, it's going really well. Listen, I got so much I want to talk to you about. You know, you have that wonderful newsletter. It's called, for all of you that wink, wink, want to get a copy of this, which I recommend very highly. It's called Stocks Under $10, and that used to be a small universe of stocks.
It used to be biotechs, and now you know what? I kind of like when the markets are going down because it makes me feel a little bit better. But the newsletter is actually a lot of fun right now, and it's doing pretty well, too.
So you're limited to stocks under $10, right?
Pretty much, yes.
Okay, and you talk about the opportunities, and in fact, it's interesting. I mean, I guess there's two things that can happen a lot of times. Stocks under $10, in theory, I guess there's certain rules, of course, with you know exchanges and listings under $5, but stocks under $10 could either go to kabush, kaplot, kaput, or we could be a real winner here. They're not necessarily small caps; they're just dollars.
No.
But they used to be. But tell me about give me some examples of a stock here or there that you may be talking about in your newsletter.
Well, there's a very small stock that just went under 10 today. You probably heard of it. It's called General Electric.
Ooh, that's brutal.
That's one of them. You know what's really unbelievable is like you said, it's not necessarily small caps, but almost 25% of the S&P 500 now trades under 12. And the reason why I use 12 is because one down day and a lot of those stocks are under 10, but enormous amount of companies are coming in. So there's I don't want to say it's getting fun on the market where a lot of people aren't doing good, but you just get a lot more names to look at and high quality, good balance sheets, and also good growth profile. So the names are increasing, which is pretty good. So I get a nice list to look at now.
Yeah. So, and what do you do? You analyze from what angle, because I mean, many of these companies, are you trying to hit the more thinly traded positions or undiscovered, or what's the again these days? It's a little bit different right now, but I mean, generally speaking, what is your what is your love in there? Are you looking for something that just has an incredible growth opportunity?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's actually as hard as it is to say that there's really no rules. So sometimes I look at the top down, then from top down I'll look from bottom up. It depends looking at individual stocks. Number of factors go in. It's a very difficult newsletter to manage because you can't really look at your typical growth profile, because how many stocks that are under 10 have a huge growth profile? Most of them have come down to where they're inflection points. I mean, you could see some of them have come down to have insider buys. Some of them are widely covered. Some of them are not. So it's not really managing a specific sector. It's great because you really have to know every single industry. So you have to have at least a general knowledge of every industry. And, for instance, companies like Weatherford are now under 10, and some very large names, oil companies that are down there. So Western Digital was down under 10. That jumped all the way up to 17. And also there's small caps as well that really look good. But you have to be concerned with the debt profile now. Now, some people say, okay, this company has debt. Let me just, forget about it. Not necessarily. You just want to make sure that debt doesn't have to be paid in the short term. You want to make sure it's not could be paid maybe 2-3 years out.
Right.
And the company may present an opportunity because you're seeing capitulation and some of these stocks are coming down and they're trading at levels that they have no business being at. So sometimes we're able to pick them off at under 10 and really get a nice gain on them.
You know, it's interesting because that's a very interesting thing you bring up about the debt, because We spend a lot of time in our screens, and we do, I got maybe 3 or 4 different core screens right now that we're looking at. And sometimes my long screens will bring me short opportunities. Has that ever happened to you? You know, you're looking through your core.
Absolutely.
You're looking through your core, so you're like, oh, that's a great stock for a short. What's it doing in there? You know?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that one of the things that I'm looking at quite often, as you just mentioned, it's kind of interesting, is the debt levels. I said, you know, all things being equal, I have two companies, whether it's short-term or long-term, but I have two companies that are looking, you know, like a long that I want to look at. And one of them has a pretty big debt load there as a percent, you know, of their total overall asset base. You know, I'm going to be a little bit more skeptical about that, and that's something I'm probably going to stay away from. Do you think that rings true?
Yeah, I believe that rings true. You know, there's some of my concerns now is, again, if the debt is pushed out to 3 years and you see that they restructure and they have the credit lines, sometimes you'll see stocks trade at very cheap levels. But on the flip side of that, you really have to be careful because some of these companies, especially in the chemical sector, they really extended themselves and decided to not only spend and increase capacity, but they made these acquisitions at such higher price. Look what Dow Chemical did, Roman Haas, they were really considering still doing that. Hopefully they don't. At least it will be done at a reduced price. But when companies really extended themselves back then and really did those deals to try to expand, you know, it kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth. You really have to avoid some of those companies.
But, you know, that's an interesting thing just to bring that back. So when I recently had a conversation with David Gaffin from the Wall Street Journal, one of the things I talked about with Hewlett Packard, you and I talked about Hewlett Packard when I was on your podcast, I think, and I was talking about that.
Great call.
Thanks. You know, that this is a short, and this is something that, you know, and one of the things, the biggest issue, put everything aside, was that the management was clearly talking out of their rumpus, let's say.
You know it. Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, you talk about the Roman Haas and the Dow, and, you know, you say, you know, we hope they don't do that deal. But you remember when the deal went down, and one of the issues was about their, you know, the credit facility that they couldn't get, and there was some concern about how they would come up with the money. But then the management kept on coming out and saying that the deal would get done. You remember that? The deal's going to get done.
Yep.
But the fact is that they didn't really know that. They're just trying to keep their stock up. I mean, I know I'm talking in basics here. But what, you know, is that allowed these days? That kind of blatant, you know, twisting of the truth. I mean, I'm not going to call them liars. I don't want to get down on that. But you know, something's just not right with it. It almost seems that you're allowed to just get away with almost anything and saying anything these days. You know, unless it's just outright thievery.
I don't know. You know, you're borrowing money at what are going to be terrible, terrible terms. Because you really don't have it to purchase a company that at an enormous premium to the market, and you still, the market collapsed in the meantime, you're still going through with it. But, you know, to your point, I think you could basically say anything in this market these days, right?
It seems that way. It really does seem that way, no kidding. I mean, and you look at the Stanford situation, which just keeps on, you know, it wasn't bad enough that there was maybe $8 billion in CDs that were non-FDIC insured because they were offshore that was going to be possibly, you know, out in the cold. If that wasn't bad enough, they find out this guy has a $212 million back tax and liens due on him for 2 years. And by the way, if that's not bad enough, he's now being investigated for drug smuggling with cartels, I think it's in Mexico or somewhere in South America. I'm waiting for today that he's going to be some kind of bizarre child abusing freak that has, like, you know, that does some kind of weird things with animals. I mean,
if that's not enough, they can't even find the guy. So there's no
exactly. Well, just look for the sheep, the trail of sheep. You'll find him there.
No, I know it's crazy what's being turned up here, but that firm is definitely done, and people just in line to get their money out, so that they're pretty much a done deal. But I don't know if you ever seen the research department there. Their research is exceptional, especially for defense companies. Unbelievable, one of the best research, and I'm talking about better than Goldman, J.P. Morgan have access to a lot of these, and their research is spot on, at least for the defense sector.
Well, let me give you a little insight here. Let me give you a little little tip on what's going on there. So they closed the place down, right?
Yep.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but not really. All the traders are being invited back into the room. They have to sit there and do nothing.
Yep.
And you know, I don't know if you know about this. And they're, you know, basically just there so they can hopefully either salvage selling the company or, you know, reinstitute that division once something, you know, gets better. But we don't really know if this was a Ponzi scheme, if this was just a blatant ripoff, or frankly, none of the above, because we really don't know this at this point. There's just a lot of accusations now. There's not a lot of real fundamental clarity on any of this, is there?
No, and as you touched up on, a lot of it has to do internationally. Most of that international arm is really getting investigated, where not so much here. So again, the details are really sketchy, and I had someone actually at thestreet.com that covers this and went over the details with me, and really that was sketchy too, and she's actually, you know, been covering the story, so.
Yeah, I've been down to Antigua. You've been down there? To where? To the Antigua, where the Antigua, that's the island that the Stanford Bank is looking at.
No, I haven't been there. No.
Let's just say that it's a lovely place.
Mm-hmm.
And the bank is the centerpiece of the island. And you get there, and there's really not much going on down there. And it's pretty interesting how you have a multi-billion-dollar operation going on there. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
you would think that this guy went to his apartment the other night after finding out that he had these problems, pushed a button, all the beds and all the evidence got burned automatically.
Mm-hmm.
Two suitcases spilled out of the closet, one filled with hundreds, one filled with clothes. Basically, he got in his car and took off. And, and he knew this was coming because this was real strange. But let me ask you a different question here. You work for thestreet.com. You guys got some great stuff. You have a boss who's pretty well known there.
A little bit, yeah.
Rants and raves and gets a little bit. This guy Jim Cramer, he's on one hand he's a god to people, on the other hand he's the devil. You know, I mean, you got people who, you've probably seen some of these guys that spend their whole life trying to deconstruct everything that he says, and mm-hmm. and as much criticism as he takes, the one thing we do know, and you know much better than I, of course, and I like you to tell me, smart guy. I mean, the guy. He's like a cauliflower brain that he keeps all this amazing amounts of information inside of his head and really provides an amazing amount of information. But at the same time, it's pretty hard to kind of please an audience, you know, of millions of people on the fly in 1 hour period of time. So, I mean, you think, I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you if he's getting a bum rap or not. But, I mean, it's a pretty tough job he's got.
It's a very tough job considering that he comes up with 3 stock picks almost every day. So right. It's very difficult. So, you know, I think when we measure the stocks, there's only 2,000 stock picks. So, you know, on average, even if you got 60% of them right, which is a very good percentage, you still got a significant amount wrong, and a lot of people focus on that. Now, you know, you talk about performance issues. You know, everyone has tough performance issues, but, you know, one thing I do like about Jim, and there's going to be no bias here, believe it or not, because if you listen to my podcast, The Real Story, I tell it how it is that after you read Jim's work, you know exactly where he stands. Well, I'm buying this stock now, which opens him up to criticism, but at least you know where he stands because you know as well as I do. So many people in this market, they'll say, well, I think there's certain factors where we're going to hit the low pretty soon, which means if we hit the low, they're going to tell everybody that they got it right. And if we don't, they're going to say, well, I said we could hit the low. So with Jim Cramer, it's yes or no, and at least right. You know where you stand. And you got to kind of like that as an investor.
Yeah, I do, and you know, try to get rhetoric free. So let's skip into the whole idea of rhetoric, which is something that I think you and I have talked about, and let's talk about the rhetoric coming from high above, the bold and swift and you know, back to basics conversations by President Barack Obama on you know, doing a lot. I think he's doing, you know, and I'm probably gonna get a lot of mail on this, but I think he's doing an interesting job, and I'm not sure how I score him yet because we'll. A little longer, I want to see what's happening here. But one of the things that I do know is he's really good at posturing, really good at posturing. And, you know, it's interesting. When you used to watch George Bush on television, you would see the stock market as he was talking drop off and then pop up afterwards. When Barack Obama talks, it kind of goes up and then drops off.
Yeah, but it's kind of funny, right?
What about this housing bill? I mean, we're talking about $250 billion, I mean, or so. We can, you know, round number here, a billion here, a billion
well,
there.
What I'm going to say has nothing to do with if it's Obama, and you know sometimes I get a lot of emails saying, you know, you have no good things to say about him. He's doing everything he said he was going to do. You knew he was going to get into office within the first couple of months. He was going to spend money. He was going to make a difference. He said he was going to change. He's doing everything he said. So you have to admire him on that front. The housing bill is absolutely horrible. It's absolutely horrible. It's not going to work. You just think about it. You're trying to keep people in homes they can't afford. You've got to restructure the interest rate when these people can't even afford to pay the principal. Now, there's studies coming out, and I've done a lot of research on this, where 40% of the homes bought since 2003 are now have negative equity. So you're going to cherry pick from that group who should get the loans, but in essence, you're telling everybody else that why would you even pay your mortgage if you're not going to get chosen? Say if you fall outside that range by a couple of $100 or whatever it is. Why would you even pay? First, you'll go in front of a judge, and you can say, all right, I want my loan restructured. And if he says no, then you know what? Hey, foreclose, take the home. I don't care. But hey, under this bill and the way it's set, I believe you're going to see even more foreclosures down the line.
Well, Back up. Let's back up. Talk to me about that. How are you going to see more foreclosures? Has it made it more difficult to get through the process, to get more hoops, in other words? What is it that, what specifically are you saying that, that makes it more difficult?
Well, one thing is, Sheila Bair came up with a plan to restructure mortgages.
And Sheila Bair from FDIC.
FDIC chair. She came up with a plan and had good intentions trying to keep these people in homes. And you know what? 50% of those homes are now back in foreclosure. Countrywide just came out with a report, said the same thing, saying that, and this is not too long ago, that, you know, restructuring loans is not the way to go. These people can't afford to pay the principal. You're restructuring their interest rate. Essentially, even if it's zero, they can't pay the principal.
Yeah.
Now, you're looking at this where 40% of the homes have negative equity. And if you have negative equity in your home, I mean, if you think about that, you know, now President Obama is going to say, okay, you know what, only a few, or what he calls responsible people, are going to get bailed out here. What about everybody else who has negative equity? Why would you pay for your mortgage if you know that the, your neighbor just got bailed out, they got money? And let's talk about these responsible people for a minute, because these are some of the people that actually took out home equity loans to buy 3 flat-screen TVs, brand new cars, and now when the housing market did not turn in their favor, now you're using taxpayers' money, or people who essentially did the right thing. You're taking money from them and just redistributing it to these people who he calls responsible.
It seems to me it's the Robin Hood mentality. The one thing that we really was concerned about with the redistribution of wealth. Remember, it really wasn't brought up towards the end of the campaign, but in the beginning of the campaign, there was a lot of talk about this whole redistribution of wealth, which was nothing more than Robin Hood. That's all it was. And by the way, let me say something. There was a reverse Robin Hood done for a long time by the banking industry in general, mm-hmm. and the investment bankers. I mean, there's a lot of robbing from the poor and giving to the rich, and that is Citibank's motto, I think. That's what mm-hmm. they did. Them in particular, they were all about going to lower income areas and saying you can get a house, and it was more than criminal. Let's just leave it at that.
Yes.
But I'll tell you something that I don't necessarily believe that, you know, I don't know if you do either, but there's this belief that you stop the housing spiral and the market stabilizes. And I'm
absolutely
thinking about, it does, but it doesn't. Hold on a second. Why?
Okay.
Where? Tell me where the correlation and when the and the relationship is. On two parts. You get one part is, let's call it the, let's just make it simple, upper mm-hmm. Earning people, you know, the people that had, let's say, the your regular Joes who have market interest and housing and all that, and the people right now, just right now, and there's no, just to make sure this is clear, it's not a good or bad, I'm just separating this, okay? The people that can't afford their homes right now, don't have jobs, how does it help them, how does it help the market? Is it because, well, you tell me, but is it basically a daisy chain back to the banks, back to the financials, back to the market from there? Is that what you're telling me?
Basically, we're seeing a whole destruction of assets. And they want, and they believe that if you, or even I believe, if you somehow could stabilize housing where all this mess actually started in the first place, and the unbelievable amount of liquidity it created in the market, if somehow you could stabilize it by stabilizing foreclosures, because they say if less foreclosures will actually not raise, but stabilize home values of people who are paying their mortgage that live in that neighborhood. So they're saying as more foreclosures come to market, that's going to make home prices come down even further and more deterioration. So they're looking to stabilize it. Now, if this plan goes through and it works and the economy somehow magically turns around in the next 6 to 12 months, then it will work and it's a good plan. But I think we both know that, you know, unemployment, where it's going, and people getting laid off, and, you know, they're distributing, I believe it's 31%, they're going to restructure the mortgage.
Yeah, 31%. That's unbelievable.
Of their income. But the thing is that their income is not stable. Everybody's cutting, I mean, the incomes are getting cut left and right. Not only that, people are losing their jobs. So if you continue to lose jobs and you restructure these loans, they're going to go back into foreclosure. Now, with that said, and people are going to say, well, you know, what's the solution here? Well, one of the solutions is, as crazy as it sounds, is let the market, let people foreclose. Now, as crazy as that
sounds. Oh, my
sounds,
God, not that.
Yeah, I don't know if you ever tried to buy a foreclosed home, but it's nearly impossible.
Right.
Okay, if you want to buy a regular home, you could go on a number of websites, and they come up. You just put 3 bedrooms, how many square feet you want, and they'll come up. For a foreclosed home, it's very difficult to buy.
You
got to
be a specialist. You got to go to the court steps. Oftentimes,
exactly.
not in all cases, but you have to go there, and then you have to go through the process. You have to be an expert in the thing, because it's basically a bidding war, and oftentimes against somebody else that's another expert.
And there's no incentive for even the brokers, who a lot of people don't like, okay, fine, but there's no incentive for the brokers to even pitch these houses because it takes a long time, and it's all about the bank, whether they're going to do it or not, whether they're going to give you the house or not. And then go 6 or 9 months, and they're not going to get their fee. So they're really not inclined to sell these houses or sell foreclosed homes. And on the flip side, what about the people on the sidelines? There's a ton of people on the sidelines dying to get into this market. And the stimulus plan did nothing for them. I mean, you basically kept a little bit of a tax credit. We're looking for a $15,000 tax credit, which we didn't get. There's no incentive where people are on the sideline saying, you know what, I have to buy a house right now. I'm going to miss this. It's not like the stock market where sometimes you feel like, okay, I got to get in. I think we're going to rise. Or, you know, look, you know, I don't want to be left on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. There's none of that in the housing market. And people, there's no rush to get in.
But this has happened before.
And rent and be happy.
Frank, this happened before, right? We've had a housing meltdown, maybe not at this level. Although the difference here is the difference with the market meltdown right now, the difference with everything right now is the absurd amount of credit that was obliterated during this process. And that one
Absolutely.
More thing that will never be again. Right?
I agree with you. I couldn't agree more. And mm-hmm. you've been warning that for a very long time,
mm-hmm.
which is great. But and you know, saying that on your podcast is such a long time. And it's true. And I think we don't get that. Because the politicians that are actually making these stimulus plans or the housing plan, they have 3 or 4 houses, and their net worth is more than $1 million. They're not in a position to be making. They really don't understand the market, in my opinion.
Yeah,
to say, hey, you know what? They don't understand how the credit has left this system. You're trying to lend people money that they have terrible credit. I mean, that's how we got in this.
Well, the other thing is they talk about...
It's not logical.
How about the logic of, you know what, we have this big credit problem. Credit is bad, so what we're going to do to bail you out is give you more credit. Hello? I mean, what is that? How does that work?
And Andrew, what's wrong with saving? I mean, listen, people say, okay, you're going to save, and the economy is going to be terrible if people save. Eventually, that money is going to come back into the economy, and you know, we're so fixated on tomorrow, 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 tomorrow. You know what? It's like public companies. They're so fixated on making a quarter, especially in the small cap area. Some of the companies I look at for stocks under 10, that, you know what? You should have a 2-year plan. It's like same store sales. They report every month. You have to be kidding me. It's not an indication of business. So it's just very frustrating. I think that if you're saving now, it's a good thing for later on. That money eventually is going to come back into the market when confidence increases. And that's
confidence is low right now.
Save.
Yep. Let me ask you a question that's been bugging me. Well, it's not about you, but it's been bugging me. Plunge protection team. I know that sounds ridiculous. I know that people listen to it. What the heck is that? There's a theory that there is a shadow group that watches over, and when they get the wink by whoever it is in the government, whether it's a Goldman, Merrill, well, not Merrill anymore, but maybe Morgan, whoever it is, that they get the green light to kind of maybe buy some futures or buy baskets of ETFs or stocks, or, you know, try to, you know, make sure that the stock market doesn't go willy-nilly. Now, what we've seen before is option expiration. Interesting movement, you know, when we've seen, I've done some studies on this. I'll be honest with you, there's not absolute evidence of what I'm going to tell you, but there seems to be anecdotal evidence that shows that if we're by a round number on the S&P, 800, 850, 900, but clearly the double zero, the 800s, the 900s, the 1,000, mm-hmm. and we've seen a couple of days down prior significantly that there is a major move to try to bounce it the day of option expiration, and there's oftentimes a lot of governmental movement as well that, you know, tries to take it up, whether it's a Fed announcement of, well, I guess they can't do this anymore. Fed, can you imagine the good old days when the Fed would just come out and say that they're going to reduce and ease rates?
Can't
do that anymore, right?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's unfortunate. Japan even kept their rates unchanged at 0.1%.
Yeah. But now you got, you know, like you got little Johnny, your grandson, you know, bouncing on your lap, and you're like, hey, Johnny, I remember the days when we had this Federal Reserve that could actually reduce rates. but do you think there is something to that, or is it just so much of a urban legend that it's just silly?
I don't know if it's an urban legend. I mean, I don't want to agree with everything here. I think I agree with you on everything.
Uh-oh.
Okay. That's cool. Now I get invited back.
Yeah, of course.
Hey, think about this. Just like you said, has the Fed come out with an announcement when the markets were up? I mean, it seems like every time we hit a low, they come out with another announcement. It's like the housing stimulus package. They came out with it. You know, Geithner's speech, which, you know, a lot of people want to blame Geithner. But, man, I mean, how does the Obama administration throw that guy out there with nothing to say?
Yeah, I was
after
mentioning, you know,
Obama
I was talking,
had this,
I was talking about this. Yeah,
the day before.
The Washington Post article. Do you see the Washington Post article that covers this? I was talking to Gaffin about this. There's an interesting Washington Post article from last week that talks about, I'll try to send it over to you, talks about how he wasn't happy with the way the plan was going. He thought it was a real issue. He scrapped it at the last minute but kept the meeting going. That's what happened. Why he stalled it.
I didn't see that, but I tell you one thing about Geithner. It was obviously a disappointment in the market crash that day because I think, you know, the president got on the day before and said, I'm not going to take any questions on the economy. Well, you know, I don't want to step on Geithner's toes. But you know what? He, if you really look at the details, saying we have to do what's in the best interest of the taxpayers, and we have to think about this. You know what? Compare that to TARP, which was flip-flopped three times around, three times now, and you know Paulson got on and basically scared the hell out of everybody, saying we need to do this immediately. To the point where when it didn't get voted in, you know, the markets crashed, and you know I guess they revoted again, right? Throw a couple things in there, and everybody's going to change their minds. And then it turns around that was a wrong decision, and we're talking about months later. He they were going to buy the bank assets, then they weren't. Now we're saying that that's a good move. So we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars here. Sit down with the smartest people in the room. If it takes a year, so what?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I really like the way Geithner presented himself. And again, I'm not saying I didn't agree with there was such high expectations going into that speech. It was terrible that he didn't say anything, but I do like the fact that he was more concerned about the taxpayers. And says, okay, let's play this out and see, and let's talk about this a little longer, and then come out with a plan.
That was refreshing. I agree with you. I mean, the whole Paulson thing. My take on it is that he had an obscene amount of guilt going into this because he was one of the main players with his firm Goldman. it seems to me when I think Goldman, I think of is that Yale who has the club, what was it called, the cloak? You know, they have that special fraternity. That Bush was a part of and all. I think of this kind of, black-hatted, cloaked group sitting in a room talking about how they're going to push oil prices through the roof and they're going to, expand the allowable leverage and multipliers for mortgages and they set up a plan and how we're going to do this and how we're going to open up a Dubai market for oil exchange and utilize the Enron loophole.
Yes, yep.
I'm seriously. I mean, this is what, every time I hear the word Goldman, I'm like, ugh. I mean, I don't understand. They used to be premier. They seem like terrorists to me. Financial terrorists.
I don't know. What's with Harvard, Yale, and Goldman? What's going on?
I don't know, but I'm not going to get a job there, I don't think, if I keep going this way. I'm
going to go on negative emails for people. Yeah.
Exactly.
I don't know. Maybe they all read the same textbook or something. Yeah, I don't know.
Exactly. All right, so listen, your stocks under 10 is available. How do people get that?
You can go to the street.com website and you click right on the services. It's a Stocks Under 10 newsletter, or you can email me at frank.curzio, C-U-R-Z-I-O, at thestreet.com. And I happen to be one of those guys that do answer all my emails. So if you want to criticize, feel free. That's cool as well.
Oh, good. I'm going to write you later about something then.
I'm used to that from you.
And, of course, you can check him out. I'll put links to this, the real story. He does a market wrap every single day talking about all the important things in the market, brings on some great guests. And that can be found on iTunes and all various podcatcher things and programs. So I hope to speak to you soon, and we'll see if we can work out this kink. You announced it, so we're going to have to follow through with it, that I'm supposed to be writing, doing some work for the street.com's, the real money subscription service. So we'll find out how that plays out, and we won't hold your feet too far to the fire on that one. But next time I'm in New York,
hold me to it because if it's up to me, I'd have you on. I think you've done a great job, not just saying that, because we're in a market where people pat themselves on the back for making one good call, even though they made 10 bad calls. Yeah. But you've done a lot to preserve a lot of capital.
I appreciate it. Thanks. And you're awesome, too. And so next time in New York, we're going to have a big, fat, juicy steak together.
Sounds great, man.
All right, buddy. Have a good day. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
You too.
Well, thanks again for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here saying have a safe week. We got a full week, all 5 days of glorious trading, investing, and I hope that a lot of this has sunk in, that you are doing a good job at hedging, watching your sell stops, and being very careful. Just buying and walking away right now is not in your best interest. Not in your best interest. That doesn't mean it won't be there again one day, but right now it's not. So I hope to see you again next week. Spread the word. If you haven't checked it out yet, good news, by the way. Dvorak Horowitz Unplugged, DH Unplugged, is a website and a podcast. If you haven't checked it out, I think you'll enjoy it. As a matter of fact, tell some friends about that. Let's run that up the iTunes charts, don't we? Don't we? Won't we? Go to dhunplugged.com and subscribe on iTunes. There's a couple of buttons there, Zoom, iTunes, and whatever how you listen. And let's make sure to make that happen. I think you'll enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. John Dvorak and myself, it's kind of, you're like listening in on a conversation we're having, during the evening, just talking about finance and investments, politics, and all sorts of stuff in between. And, you know, he can get a little cranky and I can get a little ranty, and it becomes a lot of fun. So check that out. Anyway, I'll see you real soon. Thanks for listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.